This podcast is sponsored by Q Interactive, Pearson's iPad-based system for testing, scoring, and reporting. Experience unheard-of efficiency and client engagement with 20 of our top tests delivered digitally. Sign up for your free 30-day trial at pearsonclinical.com/speechscience. Then call 1-800-627-7271 to use promo code SPEECHSCIENCE for 10% off your new Q Interactive license. Offer valid until December 31st, 2018.
Please listen carefully.
What is communication?
The act of taking a thought from my head and putting it into your head.
Essential behavior of life. We have the both blessing and responsibility of trying to foster
it. It's the strongest way for two people to convey information to each
other. What I have in my head to the outside world
draws us out of ourselves, draws us into that relationship, you know, builds up our families. Without it, we'd be lost.
I think it's the ability to share your innermost feelings and thoughts with
Whatever
others.
Whatever it is that we do to express intent and achieve an impact.
Communication is the ability to express your needs, wants, frustrations, and desires to anyone that you feel needs to have that information.
Welcome to episode 52 of the Speech Science Podcast. I'm Matt Hott, joined from the South, Michelle Wintering.
How's it going, Matt?
And out East, Michael McLeod.
What's up, buddy?
I figured Cincinnati East, I'm going to go with that. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, okay, I'll take it.
All right, full disclosure, we are recording this the day after daylight savings has ended, and I am exhausted.
I have felt like it is 9 p.m. since 5 p.m. today.
Me too. It literally feels like it's like past midnight.
And we're recording at 9, yeah.
We have officially hit old age when 9 o'clock is, ooh, I gotta go to sleep.
Man, and then this baby speech science is all thrown off by the time change too.
I've had the weird part is I've had a pretty good weekend. I bought a new chainsaw. I cut down a tree branch. I went to a Brazilian steakhouse tonight and had 15 different types of meat.
Did you say you built a fence too? Was that?
Oh yeah, and I laid a fence post in. I finally became manly man, strong muscles, and I dug a post pole for a fence and dropped in a 7-foot post. So
you're checking off the stereotypical man points this weekend.
Yes, you are a true adult. It's amazing.
Oh, it's Parks and Rec. Who's the, not Ron Burgundy.
Ron Swanson.
I've eaten 15 meats, dug a post, bought a chainsaw, and cut down part of a tree.
And now you're hosting a podcast.
And now I'm hosting a podcast.
There you go.
I am. I'm a little worried, and maybe this is a little bit TMI, but I'm afraid I'm going to get like the meat sweats later from eating so much steak and lamb and chicken. I might just go into food coma later.
Is that a thing? Meat sweats?
Well, when you're a fat guy and you eat a lot of meat.
Yeah. You'll get the meat sweats while you're editing all of our audio.
Oh, how's your weekend been, Michael? Have you had 15 types of meat this week?
I have not. Pretty much my parents came down to Philadelphia, spent some time with them, just getting ready for the work week. I broke my hand as well.
So. I'm really sorry if you guys are hearing a cat purring right now. No. Jumped in my lap.
I see it. I can see it on your lap.
So were you punching the wall? Were you saving a baby goose? How did you break your hand?
It was pretty much just like from a fall, just, you know, catching myself from a fall and just broke one of the bones, but it's all good. No worries.
Are you in a cast or a splint? What are you?
Like one of these like wraparound things.
Yikes, buddy.
They wanted to put me in like a hard cast, but I said, no, I refuse.
Yeah, man. I would have went with the hard cast. I'm not going to lie.
No, no way. I'm not going to get stuck in one of those things.
There was Matt. Do you remember? I remember in grad school at Ohio University, there was an ad put out asking for volunteers to be put into a cast to cast their non-dominant arm for a certain period of time for X number of dollars for a research study.
In yes,
the physiology department or something.
I remember being poor enough that I thought about doing that.
Having been in a cast, there's no way. It would have to be a very significant amount of money for me.
Yeah. When I was in grad school, all it had to be was dinner. Michelle, how's your week been? Are you in any cast this week?
Thankfully, no. My goodness. We had a lot of trick-or-treaters in our new neighborhood. It is the mecca of trick-or-treating. There were lines on our porch. We did it on Tuesday night because there were major thunderstorms. They moved it from Halloween to the day before. But we could not, there was no closing the door between trick-or-treaters. You had to stay on your porch, and there were lines of 10 to 15 kids at a time during the busiest parts of it to give out candy.
Oh, I love Baker's Night.
Yes, Baker's Night. That's not around the country. It's not, what, do you know that, Mike? Is it called Baker's Night where you live?
I've never heard of that before, ever.
See? Yeah. That's a very regional thing, Matt.
I had never heard of Baker's Night until I lived in Columbus, to be honest.
What is that?
It's trick-or-treat.
What?
Yeah, it's just called Baker's Night.
Wow. Have you guys ever heard of Mischief Night?
Isn't that the night before Halloween?
That's the night before Halloween, where everyone throws eggs at people's houses and toilet papers at people's houses, things like that.
Huh. Now, we had trick-or-treat on Mischief Night, then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've always heard, like, Baker's Night, it's like a regional thing, and also, like, if you have trick-or-treat on a night that is not Halloween.
Which, growing up in Columbus, that was really common for it to not be on Halloween.
Yeah, I've always was on Halloween, so I guess when I lived there, that was why I never knew.
Maybe that's why the name came a different, name was different, I don't know.
However, Mischief Night sounds fun.
It's crazy. Isn't it so crazy how that happens? How, like, different regions have these different traditions?
I love that stuff.
That blows my mind.
The language we use for it, it's so common. For me, I always called it Baker's Night. So when I moved to college and people said, "What are you talking about?" it seemed odd to me.
I was talking to somebody who celebrates the Day of the Dead. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about, like, well, what do you guys do with the... with Halloween, and she was basically telling me that, like, they don't celebrate it because it's considered, like, the devil's birthday and all that kind of stuff.
Well, living in El Paso for the last several years, Day of the Dead is a huge celebration there. And then I think with the movie Coco coming out a year ago, awareness for that is kind of more in pop culture.
I just watched Coco again today. I love that movie.
It is a good movie. I like that one. I think they're coming out with a sequel.
No.
I know. I don't know what the sequel is going to be, but.
Michael, have you seen Coco?
No, but I've seen that video of that. I think it was like a six-year-old boy, and he's, like, playing the theme song to Coco on his guitar for a brother that I think there was a miscarriage, I think.
And
you remember that video?
I do.
That was like.
Is it going to make me cry?
Yes.
Definitely.
Okay.
100%.
Don't watch it. I'll put it in the link, though.
But it was so nice to see, though, like, to be able to see, like, a young kid, like, coping and finding a positive out of a negative. It was nice.
You know, the more I read about the Day of the Dead, I really like it as a holiday, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, there's definitely some positives to it.
Yeah.
Are you going to have an ofrenda to honor your relatives of the past?
I have a family tree that I've been working on, so does that count?
Sure, we'll count it.
Oh, we want to hear from you. Do you have an ofrenda? Are you doing Baker's Night? Head over to our website, podcast.speechscience.org. From there, give us a phone call, 614-681-1798, or give us an email, speechscience2018@gmail.com. If you're also a texter. Yeah, what's up?
Matt, shout out, speaking of email.
Shout out.
To an email we got with the changeover for our new email address. We missed this one for a little while, but I was able to write back and communicate a little bit with one of our listeners, Courtney Claxton. So shout out to her, who is going to be starting her CFY here soon.
Hey, welcome to the field. Yay. Hope you survive. No, that's like an old X-Men thing, but... Good. All right. I like that. We want to hear from you. And if you're a typer, not a talker, hashtag Speech Science, you can find us on the Twitters. Coming up today, how involved is your principal in special ed meetings? Also, can a robotic arm change the lives of stroke patients? And interweaving anxiety disorder and stuttering. We'll find out what that means right after the break.
Some knowledge belongs to us and us alone. The way our girlfriends walk, the way they talk, the way they touch their hair. We hold details that only a sister can know about her girls. But what about our other girls? The ones that we carry with us every day. Can we describe them when everything's right? Can we feel when something's wrong? Our bond with our sister girls gives life. But knowing your breasts can save it. You don't know Go to knowyourgirls.org for the facts you need on breast health. That's knowyourgirls.org, brought to you by Susan G. Komen and the Ad Council.
Okay, men, this is your time. Maybe you didn't choose this, but you're here now. You're gonna go out there and be an all-star caregiver. It's up to you. So what are you gonna do? You're gonna go grocery shopping, cook, clean, be there emotionally and physically. You gotta dig deeper. Drive them to physical therapy, doctor's appointments. Don't you forget about the pharmacy. I know you won't, because that's what caregivers do. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. This is your time to show the world, your family, and yourself that you're tougher than tough. Now go out there and be the best caregiver this world has ever seen. Caregiving is tougher than tough. Find the care guides you need at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Do you have an idea for a product or book? Or are you ready to go beyond in-service presentations? Well, how do you get started? And what if you don't have any business experience at all? Well, I have some great news for you. I'm Mei-Ling Chan, and I'm getting the nitty-gritty stories from parents, teachers, therapists, advocates, and people with disabilities who have created successful businesses, and they're sharing their intimate stories with you. Listen to us on the Exceptional Leaders Podcast and fast-track creating and building and sharing your idea with the world so that you can help more people.
Welcome back to Speed Science. I'm Matt Hott, joined, as always, by Michael McLeod.
What's up?
And Michelle Wintering.
Hello again.
Michael, I always want to, like, now with your broken arm, I kind of want to say the one-arm man.
I still have two arms.
Still have two, but you can only use one.
No, I can use the other one, just not well.
In my brain.
Is it your dominant arm?
Yes, it is.
Shoot, I'm sorry.
That's all good.
Yeah, if you were a horse, they'd put you down on the backstretch.
Definitely.
Oh, that is so depressing.
No doubt about it.
A little less depressing. How involved are principals in special education? According to Education Drive or educationdive.com, they say they are, quote, a vital part of special education success. I like the principals I work with. Most of the principals I have show up and are active during meetings. I can't say that about every principal I've ever worked with, but the current ones I can say so.
Yeah, one thing this article says is, quote, one part lawyer, one part counselor, and a little bit fearless. So I think this article is incredibly well written, and it's clearly written by someone who knows well of special education in the school system. And I really agree with a lot of the points. I've been in a lot of IEP meetings with principals there, and they really need to multitask. And being in the school system as a child, I had no idea that these were all the things that principals were doing behind the scenes.
And I'll say that some of the best principals I've worked with, and this isn't to say you have to have special ed experience to be a principal by any means, or to be a very good principal who supports special needs, but some of the best that I've worked with, I can think of a couple, are those who had special education experience prior to becoming a principal. And I think that's just because I would see them in that situation. So I'd see them sitting in an IEP meeting or supporting that special ed teacher or the accommodations that were needed, because you have to go through that hierarchy to get those accommodations a lot of times. So the principal is a built-in part of that. And some of the best that I've worked with have had that sort of special heart for that special population.
Michael, have you ever worked directly in schools? I forget. I know I ask that probably on a weekly basis.
I contract with a few schools.
Okay.
I'm not like directly employed by the schools.
But you have to write your own speech only IEPs?
Yes.
How long does your meeting last? On a typical ARTIC or fluency IEP, how long would your meeting last?
Just a typical IEP meeting, you mean?
Yeah, just like for a speech only, typical IEP meeting, nothing really surprising, you're not trying to dismiss, just kind of parents are happy. How long does your meeting last?
I would say on average 45 to 60 minutes.
Okay. Michelle?
When I was in the school, this was kind of a hot topic. We loved to keep them at an hour, but often they were a lot longer than that because I didn't have any kids who were just in the school.
I didn't have any kids
who were just speech.
So my speech only meetings last maybe 15 to 20 minutes.
Not bad.
I could say some of our simpler cases.
Yeah. And I think
straightforward. I shouldn't say simple, but just more straightforward cases.
And I bring that up because I had a principal who was one of the worst ones I've ever worked with. And I would always have my meeting. It would last maybe 15 or 20 minutes because I would send it home to the parent. They would read it over. We would meet and I'd say, do you have any questions? And they would say, no, maybe some questions about grades, but nothing really, because at the high school level, if it's a fluency kid, it's, you know, they've kind of been working on it for a while. The meeting would end and then we would have to wait 10 or 15, maybe 20 more minutes till the principal would show up.
Did the principal always have to be at your IEP meeting?
He was our district rep.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, you just said, though, Matt, one thing you did to help with time on that is you made sure that you did the prep work beforehand and communicated with the parents well beforehand. That's always something that with IEPs, especially when you're dealing with more than just speech, was always a challenge. At least I would come across, because you have how many different providers or teachers needing to put in input. And if not everyone has a chance to do that, because there's those times of the year, especially that are just bogged down with IEPs, that sometimes there's last minute information being put in, and that really has to be sort of sifted through at a meeting, and it just adds time.
How many, was your district rep your principal, Mike?
Yes.
Okay. Michelle?
No, well, again, different sort of situation, because we were technically our own district.
Okay.
That's the state school for the deaf and the blind.
That's fair.
Like, we had our own superintendent.
Yeah, I feel like a good principal can really salvage a meeting. A terrible principal can derail the meeting in a heartbeat.
So can a terrible therapist.
Even good ones derail the meetings when they talk too much.
Yeah, that's true.
FYI, soapbox, if you're the SLP or the therapist or the intervention specialist who gives everyone a copy and then reads everything word for word, please stop.
It's kind of like any lecture we've been to where they just read the slides.
Oh, I'm so over that. But yeah, no, okay. So yeah, I'll put the link down here in our show notes. But overall, it feels like we've had pretty good examples of good principals in IEP meetings.
I usually come away very impressed with how they, even if our opinions differ, or I'm pushing for one thing to be in the IEP and they're arguing for another, I typically come away very impressed with how they multitask and how they present themselves and overall manage the meeting.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, especially the last principal I worked with, shout out to Jamie in Colorado. She was fantastic. She really really supported the special service providers.
We had one principal, he's retired a couple years ago. He had a tendency to send home kids for a couple days out of school, one of those type of principals. And one of my students was getting, this kid graduated a couple years ago as well, was getting kind of on the edge of being kicked out of school for a few days. And I told the, met with the principal and said, hey, sending him home is not going to help. He's not the type to see that as a negative. He just, he'll see that as a reward. We had a meeting with the parent. And the parent's like, yeah, no, I'm not bringing him back to school. And the principal's like, all right, fine. Out of school suspension. And I'm like, come on, man. He's going to be rewarded with video games.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
And I always love to see the principals that you can tell when they truly have the teachers and the SLPs back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're really just like, you can tell that they stand up for them no matter what. And if they make a mistake, they have their back, and they're really there to really advocate for them. Even when I'm in an IEP as an outside therapist, as a private therapist, I love to see that. I love to see school teams that just really rally for each other.
Yeah, I got nothing. I agree with that 100%.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a good or bad principal story, hit us up. podcast.speechscience.org. It's speechscience2018@gmail.com or 614-681-1798. In the realm of stroke rehab, there are many snake oil salesmen, and there's also a few good products. This coming out of medicaldevice-network.com. They're looking at Hong Kong researchers creating a robotic arm to help stroke patients to help facilitate the muscle movements required for rehab. And this kind of this sparked a couple ideas for me about some of the better and some of the worst ideas I've ever seen for stroke rehab. How familiar are you guys with the technological side for stroke rehab?
I'm not. I can't say that I am.
Pretty much only everything we've discussed here on this podcast is
Oh, really?
Is all I know.
Yeah, give us a little recap here, Matt. What do you mean by the technological?
So one of the best things I've ever seen, this for stroke, it's also for and for Parkinson's and neurological degenerative diseases. There's a robot called Obi. Have you guys ever met Obi?
Nope.
All right, I'm going to drop the link in the chat. Let's go to meetobi.com. And Obi is a self-feeding robot. What you do is you put the spoon to where you can eat, and then you mark where, or then you move the robot to where the food is, like the arm. So basically you're setting the maximum distances for both sides. And it's switch activated, so the patient or the student can hit a switch and it scoops food up onto the spoon, and then you hit the switch again and the spoon is brought directly to your mouth.
That is very cool.
That is fascinating.
I like that a lot. That is very, very cool.
So when I was reading this article about robotic arms to kind of help facilitate, you know, the muscle movement, and I was thinking about the PT, I'm looking at, you know, how far have we come from a technological side that when we're working with a patient, we should be looking farther into assist, and this is assistive tech. It's not just AAC.
This is fascinating.
Are you looking at the meat, Obi?
Yeah, I just pulled that up. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I got a little distracted, but I'm all about using, if we're able to use technology for good, that's the best part of technology, is when it can help people.
Yeah, there's
life easier in some way.
There's no doubt that technology is going to completely change our profession over the next 10, 15 years.
Think about what has changed in the last 10, 15 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, we can't even begin to guess or predict what it's going to be like. And not only for, obviously, if we would have to predict the areas of AAC and rehab for stroke victims and these kinds of things will be the two most affected and improved areas, because it's those are the two areas where technology really comes into play And if technology gets more advanced and more accessible, then who knows what we'll be working on or what certifications we'll be working on.
So Matt, have you seen the OB in person?
They had like a prototype at one of some meeting or some convention thing I went to 4 years ago, but he wasn't running. And then about, I would say 6 months later, the website had a bunch of videos up of OB working.
So and would it be awesome. Just one of those areas that would be a little bit of speech and a little bit more of OT?
Yeah, I think so, because like you have to look at, from the speech side, you're looking at, you know, the food process and relearning the confidence to basically gain the independence for eating. And I believe the OT would be the, you know, everything to get the food from the bowl to your mouth. But
and then we, of course, with consistencies and all that, yeah. What would be.
But Obi's pretty cool. He's got a switch to rotate the three trays. And then I'm kind of looking at some other stuff, and you've got virtual reality. We kind of looked at that last week for dementia, but you've got the same thing for virtual reality for stroke patients, the robotics.
I got some limbs, good feedback on that interview, by the way, Matt.
Really?
Nice job on the, just a couple friends who reached out and said they enjoyed that interview about the artificial intelligence. So.
Oh, perfect. I appreciate that. But yeah, so no, I feel like we're on such a weird precipice from a therapy standpoint. That technology is it replacing us or is it just augmenting us, quote unquote?
I certainly hope it's augmenting us.
I hope it is augmenting us as well. I don't think you can get rid of the clinical expertise that is a speech pathologist. You have to have someone who can use that technology, but in the same breath, just like we've said before, if suddenly that technology doesn't work, we still have to be able to do therapy.
And someone's got to write the paperwork to get it funded.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true.
I'm in the middle of writing a AAC report, by the way, thinking of technology.
Those are intense. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Shout out to PRC right now, because I am using their new funding agent or whatever, because the device ended up being a PRC device. And they have really streamlined the process over there. I'm really enjoying actually writing this one.
Nice. And there's their staff, I guess what you call it, their staff or their outreach folks are really great and will do trainings for you and everything on their devices. So
my favorite.
Anytime anyone streamlines anything for us to make it easier from the paperwork side, big ups to them.
It sounds so stupid, but like if you've done an AAC eval to request a device, you'll understand what I'm talking about. You have to do a page like document to try to get a prescription from the doctor. And one of the things that they've done to streamline it, which just seems so easy, was there's a button that says, would you like to use the smart fill? And you use it and they put your patient's name in there and their address and the doctor, everything you've already typed in for like three or four pages ago. Just auto-populates, and it makes it so nice.
That's amazing.
I love it when stuff works.
It's the little things.
Technology augmenting us.
I do enjoy a little augmentation. Head over to our website if you are using technology in your rehab, podcast.speechscience.org. From there, email us, speechscience2018@gmail.com. Or give us a phone call, 614-681-1798.
Hey, everyone. You know, let's all stop what we're doing right now and take a moment. That felt good, huh? Just like that, we had a nice, special sort of moment together. Of course, they don't all need to be quiet moments to be special. They could be loud moments, goofy moments, sporty moments, dorky moments. Moments where we talk or walk or just hang out. It doesn't really matter. They all count. Because every time dads like us take a moment like that to spend with our kids, well, it's pretty momentous. Sounds like somebody agrees. So let's take a moment to make a moment today Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
And for our last article, this is coming out of News Medical Life Sciences. Interweaving anxiety disorder associated with stuttering remains unrecognized. I will be the first one to admit that I know enough to help with my patients and students with dysfluency, but dysfluency to me is still such a hard thing to grasp with all the research out there.
I'm with you on that, Matt. I've had select patients with fluency as their focus. I think, Mike, you've mentioned before you seem to have a little more experience with fluency than I definitely do.
Yeah, I've been to a few American Institute of Stuttering meetings and different fluency meetings in New York and Philadelphia, and I've had a nice wide range of fluency students, ranging from about probably 6 to about 35. So I've had a nice mix of child and adult for fluency, and this is you know, a pretty typical article, really just stating the correlations between fluency and the anxiety. And pretty much it's basically saying that about 20% of 7 to 12 year olds seeking stuttering therapy. I think those of us out there that do treat stuttering clients and fluency clients definitely recognize this. There is the whole anxiety and self-image and overall desensitization piece that really needs to take place with the therapy that we're providing. So having that overall anxiety, I think that's something that a lot of us SLPs out there already recognize. And this is research that kind of just backs up that belief.
So looking at this article, a question for you, Mike, would this be something that speech pathologists, we would want to obviously talk to the patient about, but if they're okay with it, be able to discuss treatment and co-treat with the psychologist or with the counselor or with whoever else that they're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I obviously with the older clients, I would say I wouldn't really present this article unless they were, you know, 18 and up. And it's just a really nice way to really just show them, you know, you are not alone. There's other people out there with fluency issues and anxiety issues as well. And this would be a good thing to also share with other medical professionals like psychologists or psychotherapists. Share this article with them to inform them of the correlation between stuttering and anxiety. So it's definitely a good article to kind of spread awareness and advocate for this, you know, individuals with stuttering. So I would share it with both groups.
As you're speaking, Mike, I'm going back to what we talked about a couple weeks ago when you said that the executive functioning or the brain is kind of like a air traffic controller controlling everything. And yep. It automatically makes me assume that the more anxiety we put on, and there has been research, am I right to say that some dysfluency may be caused by a narrowing of a blood vessel in the brain? Or was that disproven?
I'm pretty sure that was disproven.
Okay. But my thought was going to the idea that the air traffic controller, the more stress you put on it, it's going to have less resources available to control good speech. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really what we're seeing here in this article. It's really, you know, the bigger amount of impact on emotional well-being, social functioning, occupational achievement, overall quality of life, you're going to see an increase in the severity of fluency. The more it's impacting your social life, your occupational life, your personal life, that's, you know, the more that you have that crossover, and you're going to see an increase in anxiety and an increase in stuttering events as well.
Fascinating. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Makes it nice and easy and convenient that the more you're worried about having a disfluent moment, the more likely you are to have a disfluent moment.
So I'm curious because my undergrad was not in speech. I think I've told you guys that before. And Matt, you were similar to mm-hmm. me with that. Had to take the longer route, leveling classes and whatnot to get into grad school. But I studied psychology and public relations, and I love sports psychology. And I think that it's tied into me coaching and all different things in my adult life, right? But one of the things from sports psychology that I remember well, and I can't remember what this phenomenon is called, but it's the idea that if you believe you're good at something, so like if you have that belief, say their example was free throws. If you think you're good at free throws, having an audience makes you better. If you think you're bad at free throws, having an audience, you perform worse.
Oh.
And I wonder if that is similar to fluency. If you have anxiety and feel that this is such a struggle for you, you end up getting worse with that audience versus someone who thinks that they're a good public speaker and they're good in that fluency piece may present as more confident in all those other things with an audience.
Yeah, the biggest phenomenon with fluency is really the different environments and the different situations where it will either increase or decrease. Fluency typically is much worse over the phone. When you have an issue, when you have an individual with stuttering or a fluency disorder, when they're speaking over the phone, that's typically the biggest anxiety producing activity they have. And that's typically when their fluency is the worst. Yeah, it's mostly because you don't have the face-to-face, you don't have body language, you don't have the nonverbals, you don't have the eye contact and the ability to have a nice cohesive back and forth with turn taking. And fluency is typically improved when you're singing or when you're talking to an animal, like for instance, you're talking to your dog or something. Or if you're most likely by yourself and just kind of in a situation where you're just using, out loud self-talk. So that's such an amazing phenomenon with this disorder is the very distinct and very basic activities you're doing where you're either going to have issues or a much easier time speaking.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now this may be a silly question, but is it true, if I remember right, that talking in an accent, and then of course I know singing, both can improve fluency?
Absolutely, yeah. Singing, talking to an animal, talking in an accent, doing like an impression of someone else's voice, acting. There's many different activities where if you're acting and you're up on stage, and you really get into the character and you're living the character, you're living out someone else's life on stage, you're able to step out of your own body and step out of your own disorder, and you're able to be more fluent.
Gosh, our brains are so fascinating. I love that stuff. I think that's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one thing that's really important to mention is a lot of what we're talking about right now in this overall discussion of fluency and stuttering is a lot of these generalities we're speaking in, of course, are not one size fits all. You are going to have individuals who are singing or are speaking in an accent or doing certain things, and they do still have fluency matters of disfluencies. So a lot of what we're speaking of right now are some of the generalities. You know, obviously, there are individuals with severe fluency disorders, moderate, mild. So a lot of what we're speaking of is more
that's
of
a good reminder,
overall generality.
Oh, I was going to say, only because when we're recording, sometimes we have our video on and sometimes we don't. And just like you mentioned on the phone where you don't have that visual feedback and body language, I feel that way even when we're recording our podcast, if I can't see you guys, that it's almost more difficult for me to really attend and focus on my responses and everything else in our recordings when I can't see you.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly how it is for someone. Imagine how it is for someone who has had so many experiences in their lives where they've been disfluent or and they've had negative social experiences and they have to call someone over the phone for either a job interview or whatever it may be, and they're not able to see the person, it's such an anxiety, just like this article talks about, it's such an anxiety-inducing experience for them.
And I did find my article that I was talking about the blood flow.
Okay.
It was out of Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. A new study demonstrated that regional cerebral blood flow is reduced in the Broca's area, the region in the frontal lobe of the brain linked to speech production in some people who stutter. More severe stuttering is associated with even greater reductions in blood flow to this region.
Interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So
I will link that in the chat, and then I will throw that into the overall.
Yeah. Part. You know what I'm talking about? When was that article
yep.
from? Okay.
Cool. 2017. So last January.
Sounds good.
So. See, I knew I wasn't a completely crazy person. It was published in the December 30th, 2016 Journal of Human Brain Mapping. So there you go.
Interesting.
But either way, my point still stands when I was talking or when I was, you know, with the idea that air traffic controller just can't control everything.
Exactly. And that's really... when I'm speaking to parents or colleagues or students, I always like to go back to that really general line, is that speech is the most complex thing the human body does. Whether it's speech, whether it's language, whether it's executive functioning, whether it's apraxia, whether it's stuttering, there's so many minuscule things that could go wrong that compound and break down in the end and make speech either non-fluent or unintelligible. This is why we're in grad school for so long, and it's such an intense process. There's so much involved in speech and language, and fluency is just one little part of it.
And everything changes too. Or not changes, but as we find more information out, it can really change a course of treatment.
Exactly. And that's really where the whole air traffic controller thing comes in, is we need to find that one little area that's messing up the whole process. We have to find the foundation of the error, and we need to be educated enough and skilled enough to be able to treat that.
There is a quote that I live by. I know we always post the Willow quote. My old high school, they had a thing called the Grad at Grad. And one of them was to always be open to growth. And I always think of that in our field, that you need to be willing to look at a study such as the anxiety or what we talked about, robotics, or involving the principal more. And if you're really stuck, you just get passed by, and your students or your patients don't get the best treatment.
I know that we have continuing education requirements, but our field is always growing. Just like Mike said earlier, how much technology is going to be changing things continuously, that we have to continue to learn more in this field. That's part of what I love about speech pathology, but it is also a challenge.
Exactly. And aside from all of the CEUs and conferences and courses I've done, there is no doubt that the most I've learned in this field is from other fellow professionals, whether it be SLPs, OTs, PTs. By having a whole multidisciplinary approach and co-training and working with them. And I've learned more from fellow SLPs, whether they're just out of their CFY or 10 years, 20 years in the field, I've learned more from working with them and sharing ideas with them than I've learned
that
from any
CEU course. That is so true, because
any
from the SLPs I've worked with to the SLPAs I've worked with there, and other therapists I've worked with, from assistants to PhDs, doesn't matter. Some of the people I've learned so much from, we talked about this before, are the aides in classrooms, because they know those kids so well, just like the parents do on a day-to-day basis. And I don't know, you can always learn from those people, and they've had a different patient than you have, or a different experience or expertise than you have.
We want to know who you've learned from. Head to our website, podcast.speechscience.org. Email us contact, or wrong email, speechscience2018@gmail.com, or give us a phone call, 614-681-1798. My little traffic controller on the inside of my brain is saying that we need to take a break. We'll be right back right after this.
As humans, we ask ourselves all kinds of questions. But what if we were forced to ask ourselves a question every day that affected the outcome of the most basic things, the most important things in our lives? The question is, what is your sexual orientation or gender identity? And the answer is the difference between keeping your job or getting fired. The answer is the difference between staying in your home or getting evicted. The answer is the difference between receiving medical treatment or not. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against people based on their answer to this question. LGBT Americans have the right to say, "I do," but they don't have the same basic rights as everyone else. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Speech Science. I'm Matt Hott. Michael McLeod and Michelle Winter are awesome.
We are all tired.
That's right.
daylight savings time. Okay, Michael, you're the executive functioning guru of the three of us.
Okay.
Why is it, and you can use the traffic controller guy that you've explained it to me before with, but why is it when I'm exhausted, my brain goes into almost haywire mode? It almost feels like I'm punched
drunk. Slap happy?
Why? Yeah, like, why does that happen? Things are funnier. I can't think of words.
That's because your brain is exhausted. Not only are you exhausted, your brain is exhausted, and it's not working properly. The whole organization input, being able to organize thought, organize internal language, everything is slowed down. You know, you need a couple of sips of Gatorade, a couple of sips of lemonade, and you'll be good to go.
So just sugar?
Sugar, exactly. Sugar helps with those things. I'm telling you, it does.
So this week, daylight savings time has ended, and they say what? It'll take 3 to 5 days or more for your body to readjust?
Yes.
It also shows an increased risk of heart attacks and traffic accidents this week.
This is why states like Arizona don't do daylight savings time.
this is why I broke my hand.
This is coming out of NPR News, not N, but M, NPR News. Here are the tips to stay healthy during dark winter days ahead. These are the tips they give you. Are you ready for it? Go to bed an hour earlier. Since it gets dark early, you should go to bed early. They say record The Daily Show or whatever you watch at night. That way you can sleep better. Okay, that's fair, right?
I think so.
Stock up on nourishing foods. So they say fish, nuts, and other plant-based proteins such as tofu are good alternatives if you don't want to add meat. But they say that you need lots of protein. So me going to the meat palooza that I went to today seems like a good idea.
Okay.
Eat dinner early and keep it light. I did not do that. But a group of dieters who ate their meal the day before 3 p.m. lost about 5 pounds more than other people did. They say join a club or group activity, which is fair. Social isolation, not good for mental health, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here's their number one tip. Are you guys ready?
Ready.
You should move closer to the equator. Michelle, Michael?
Yeah, I hear that noise.
Yeah. Michelle?
What was that?
I think it might be Michelle.
Is she at the ocean?
I think her mic just did something.
Can you hear me or no?
Yeah. We can hear you now.
What was that?
It sounded like a freight train.
I have no idea. Are you? I have no idea what that was. Good old podcast world. I didn't hear it. I don't know what you were.
Oh. Yeah, I said, okay, so their number one tip was to move closer to the equator, and then the freight train sound hit.
Okay. No, I just said, I guess that makes sense because your days would be more regulated between light and dark, closer to the equator.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, that's why they say you should move to the south during the winter and move north during the winter or summer. That sounds affordable and easily to do with a business and career. Oh, let's wrap up the daylight savings time. What is it? The hours, the clock goes back an hour, your scale goes back 10 pounds. That's what I was told this week.
Does it?
All right, Michelle, what are you doing this week?
Look, I'm picking up some of my CEUs. I got to finish up before the end of the year. I am.
Are you going to Asher?
Not sure if I'm going to be able to.
If you do, let me know. Okay. We got something that you might have to do. Michael, what are you doing this week?
Pretty much same old. Pretty much going to the schools, working in the practice. Going to Maryland at the end of the week to do some work down there. So yeah, got a pretty typical week.
For me, my school district is closed on Tuesday because of Election Day, so I get a full day to catch up on Medicaid billing from the month of October. Right. Oh, all righty. Let's send this
sounds
puppy
good.
Home, shall we? All right, our opening music was Please Listen Carefully by Jazar. Our closing music, as I pull it up here, is The Slow Burn by Kevin MacLeod and the bump music by Kevin Sobrinsky. They are all licensed under an attribution and share alike license. For Michael MacLeod and Michelle Wintering, I am what am I? I'm Matt Hott with a tired air traffic controller in my head. Saying in the immortal words of Janice Wright, be a willow, don't be an oak, because during the storm, the willow will bend and return to form. The oak will crack and be firewood. So long, everybody. See you next week.
Good night.
Peace.
Good night.
You're listening to the Exceptional Podcast Network.